Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Looking at the individual states of the 18, the report, 11 of them do have double-digit very poor-to-poor numbers. Missouri, however, still at 26% very poor-to-poor. And we have a couple other states also at or above one-fifth of the crop rated very poor-to-poor. Those are Kansas and Louisiana, as we are seeing the effect of extreme heat in some of those deep south production areas.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey on soybean setting pods.
National number 78%, five-year average 75%. Last year at this time, 72%. If you look at the variations from the five-year average, Missouri is the quickest, 14 percentage points ahead of their five-year average pace for setting pods. And the slowest is Wisconsin, 10 percentage points behind their five-year average pace.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Look, America has to be engaged around the world.
Robert O'Brien's the former national security advisor speaking at the Hudson Institute on China and global supply chains.
We've got so much goodwill around the world that we don't recognize. People speak English. They love American music. They love American culture. We've got soft power that no other country can match. And combined with our allies, with the British and the French, influence we have around the world is tremendous.
So one of the questions is, how do we deal with China? And O'Brien explains.
I've never advocated a complete decoupling with China. I think the best way to do business with China is to sell China things. And just like we buy a lot of things from China, we should sell China things. And China should have an open market so that we can sell our farm products, our agricultural goods, our minerals, oil and gas, if we produce more, raw materials, films, and entertainment products. There's a lot of Chinese want from us, and there's a lot we can sell. And selling things into China is good because it furthers the interests of America. It reduces the trade deficit. And so the idea that we should trade with China is a good idea. Traditionally, Australia has done very well with China, because they've sold things into China. The problem is when you invest in China, that's when they get their hands and their grips in you. They force you to transfer technology to them. They force you to, as soon as your company is doing well, I was involved in a couple of cases like this, they try and buy your company at a fire sale rate, or they prevent you from doing further business and put one of their companies in place. They build a parallel factory next to your factory and start knocking off the same goods so that the workers that were building, that were doing a brand name American product in the morning are going to the factory next door and doing a knockoff at night. And so I think that kind of trade with China obviously isn't helpful, but selling things into China is good. And the question you ask is, where do you make the distinction of something that is dual use or could be turned around and used against us or could be reverse engineered or that sort of thing? And what can we sell into China knowing that it's not a big problem? Legacy chips are an area where we could probably sell into China. Sell them products that aren't so advanced that they're going to give China a technological advantage in a war fighting scenario. So we just need to make those calls. But the idea of exporting things to China is good. The idea of going into China and setting up your company and working in China is more problematic and riskier. But we do have to, the idea isn't to cut off all trade with China, but the Chinese don't see it that way. They really don't want to buy things from us unless they have to. They really don't want to buy things from other countries unless they have to. They really want to, we've got kind of an autarkic system where they want to, make everything they can in China and sell outward. It's mercantilistic, it's autarkic, and we need to avoid playing into that trap. But selling our goods, selling California agriculture and Midwestern agricultural products to China, selling films to China is great, but even in those fronts, if the Chinese get upset with you, they restrict the imports, just like they did with Australian wine or with the film industry, where they only allow 10 or 12 American films, and then they use that access for those films to censor the films, to take the Taiwan patch off Maverick's bomber jacket and Top Gun. So selling into China is generally a good idea if we can do it without hurting our national security. And if we get the Chinese to open their market to allow that to happen, that would be a good thing for everybody. That's what free trade is supposed to be about, but we haven't had free trade with China for many years.
Former National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
If you're not real familiar with that, this is the idea, as Ryan referred to earlier, of going out and planting our cash crop when the cover crop is still alive and green.
Talking about planting green, based upon the National Cover Crop Survey results, Dr. Rob Myers, University of Missouri.
Maybe it's been terminated that same day. Sometimes it's terminated after planting the cash crop. So that could happen when that cover crop is still pretty small, like 4 to 6 inches tall in the upper left photo, or when that cover crop is getting pretty big, like 4 to 6 feet tall in the lower right photo. And again, a decade ago, this would have been rare that people would have been doing that, but now it's becoming a much more common practice. In fact, we saw for 2022 that 58% of the soybeans were being planted green. That's a pretty remarkable figure. A little less common with corn for a variety of reasons. And then with some of our other crops, because we didn't have a lot of users of cotton and sorghum in the survey, those numbers were low, similarly for wheat. Planting green in terms of the percentage of their total acres, there were some that were doing that on nearly all their cover crop acres, but for many it was a practice they were just using occasionally, so it just varied from farm to farm. In terms of how that planting green influenced the management, how was it making management more challenging? You know, at first glance, it would seem like, gosh, you're going out and planting in that green living cover crop. That seems tough to do, right? Well, quite a few said that they found management was actually similar or simpler, and then a similar number that it was about the same management. There were some that found it more difficult, but they felt the benefits outweighed the difficulty, and a relatively small fraction were not so sure they wanted to continue due to some management challenge, but pretty favorable overall. That's also reflected in what they experienced in terms of potential challenges. So weed control actually consistently improved for most farmers doing planting green. That's maybe not a surprise. You're letting the cover crop grow longer, so it's suppressing more, has more chance to suppress the weeds farther into the season. Sometimes farmers worry that haven't tried planting green, that it's going to cause problems with diseases or nitrogen tie-up, slugs, voles, and it can, depending on this particular field or the management approach. But the majority of farmers, those with the orange, are saying they're not seeing a big difference for those factors. And then there were a few for those that found it was actually better when planting green, that they had less problems with slugs or less problems with voles. So it varied. Certainly there could be problems with slugs and voles in those situations or nitrogen tie-up, but overall a pretty positive picture. Now, I will quickly say, as a cover crop advisor myself, I'm always cautious about telling brand new farmers to plant green. It's a little safer to terminate early or use a winter kill cover crop. But as they get experience, we're seeing many farmers find some benefits from trying this approach. And one of those big benefits is helping with moisture management. Two-thirds said it was helping them with their moisture management. Now, this was for 2022. In 23, many of our areas of the Corn Belt had relatively dry springs. And where I'm at in Missouri, it was a very dry spring. And so if we had people planting green this year, they may have run short on moisture to get that cash crop growing. This was a good year to terminate that cover crop early if you were in one of those regions with dry spring conditions. But overall, climatologists are telling us that many of our production areas are getting wetter springs on average. Again, not every year, but more consistently wetter springs. And so this can be a management tool to help in those wet springs in terms of transpiring some soil moisture, getting that field in condition to plant.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Most of the things they're calling for in this bill are already being done, have been done for years.
Steve Dittmer is the Executive Vice President, Ag Freedom Foundation, on proposed legislation to reform checkoffs.
As far as audits and checkups and making sure that none of the money goes directly to finance organizations that are going to affect public policy legislation. That's all already being done. And of course, we pointed out Mike Lee and Rand Paul are two senators who normally are very committed free market guys, promote liberty and freedom, and what they're doing hanging out with the likes of Senator Elizabeth Warren or Cory Booker, I have no idea, because they are obviously very left-leaning liberal senators. Booker has put out a plan that would basically outlaw all confined animal feeding in the country, phase it out over a couple of years. I can't imagine, and we think we've seen supply chain problems the last couple of years in agriculture, and especially in the beef industry. I can't imagine what we would go through if we no longer had any of the major feed yards. But that's the kind of thing that he's thinking about. And so I really don't understand why they're working together, and I don't understand why they're trying to, quote-unquote, reform the checkoff. We went through this about a 2 or 3 year process with RKF suing USDA and the checkoff, starting in Montana and working its way through the courts. And the only major changes that were made is some of the checkups and checkoffs and auditing procedures that had been done for years were codified into some more regulations at USDA. And the courts ended up deciding that the checkoff was constitutional. It was being run properly. It wasn't a problem. It cost the NCBA, who has to do the legal stuff. This is a separation of powers. The checkoff is beef promotion, research, and education. They can't get involved in legislation. NCBA had to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars with lawyers fighting these court battles in order to prove the checkoff was doing what it was supposed to do. We also had a referendum or a petition for a referendum a couple of years ago, and it never got anywhere near enough signatures to bring a referendum. And I think one of the things that people miss about the beef checkoff, this isn't a government program that was handed down to us or mandated or anything like that. Cattlemen across the country went into their offices and voted this checkoff in 1985 or 86. I forget exactly which year. But it was something they voluntarily decided they wanted to do to promote their industry, to provide the nutrition research, the health research, to fight the don't eat animal products movement that started in the 70s with Senator McGovern. They wanted to be able to do this themselves, to do national advertising, to do educational work, and it's been immensely successful. And if you look at the money that the checkoff has put into the U.S. meat export operation, we're approaching $500 a head for the fed animal, a value from beef exports alone, besides the boost in domestic beef demand. And those kind of things are critically important.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
So just a few years ago, and we all know this, China's economic rise provides a lot of hope.
Robert O'Brien, former National Security Advisor, speaking at the Hudson Institute on China and global supply chains.
We had this idea that, and I'll talk about this in the context of semiconductors, but just more generally, if we turned a blind eye to human rights abuses, if we turned a blind eye to Tiananmen Square and Xinjiang and Tibet, if we turned a blind eye to the extinguishing of democracy in Hong Kong, which violated the British-Sino Pact, if we allowed the continued theft of our intellectual property, if we allowed unfair trade practices, if we did all these things, China would become richer, and in turn they'd become more like us, and they'd become part of the kind of a global democratic world. And we saw just the opposite happen. What did we see? We saw China became more autocratic, more tyrannical. They used all the blessings of their membership in the WTO and their blind activities to develop a surveillance society, something that George Orwell would have been astounded by. I mean, with social credit scores and cameras everywhere and a way of life that's an anathema to us in the West. No privacy, no liberty. And so we'd hoped that they'd become different, but they haven't. And as they've recently demonstrated, the Chinese Communist Party is not interested in becoming a thriving economic partner. Instead, Beijing intends and seeks to upend the entire global economic order and place itself at the top of that order. Chairman Xi Jinping has made semiconductors, but China 2025 is what we all talk about now, which deals with robotics and AI and quantum, all of which are dependent on semiconductors. But going back to the third-party plenum in 2013, the CCP has spent over a trillion yuan trying to become the dominant player and dominant power in the world in semiconductors. And they call it the big fund in China. and they want to have an industry that dominates the entire sector. So, and like many things the Chinese have done, they've been successful. We constantly underestimate the Chinese. I'll just jump to an example of a carrier aircraft. When the Chinese bought the old Russian carrier, the Varyag, it was in Ukraine, and we were going to make it into a casino, and they spent a lot of years refurbishing it. We said, they're never going to be able to understand carrier aviation. It's going to take them 20, 30, 50 years to do it. Not only do they understand carrier aviation, they're building three of their own carriers. They're demonstrating that they can operate at sea and integrate their carrier air wing with their ships, land and launch sorties on a rapid basis from the carriers. We underestimate the Chinese, and we do that to our own detriment. And we shouldn't, because they're hardworking people, they're clever as heck, and they're motivated. They want to win, especially the party. So in 2011, China had 1,300 registered companies in the semiconductor industry. By 2020, they had over 22,000 companies in the semiconductor industry, and it's only grown since 2020. And Beijing is providing significant incentives to allow these companies to produce semiconductor chips at scale. And granted, most of these companies are focused on legacy chips and mature chips and not the super advanced chips. But while these are less technically advanced than their smaller counterparts, these chips are still critical parts of our infrastructure and our industries in the U.S., including defense. And what's amazing is that the United States and our defense industry are still buying chips, mature chips, semiconductors made in China and integrating them into our defense platforms and systems, which is incredibly dangerous. So we've got to wean ourselves off dependence on Chinese chips, including the legacy chips. And if we don't, we're vulnerable to supply chain disruptions that we saw in the pandemic.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
As someone who lives in and around Washington, D.C., you know, normally we make the joke that it's always nice to get out of Washington and into the real world.
Caitlin Glover is Executive Director for the Public Lands Council, reacting to President Biden's recent trip to Arizona.
But unfortunately, the president's trip and many other officials from the Department of the Interior and USDA, their trip to Arizona this last week, unfortunately didn't contain a lot of good news for cattle producers, for public lands grazers, and the local community. While he was there, the president used the Antiquities Act to designate a new national monument just adjacent to that Grand Canyon area, which is also a national monument. And in doing so, locked up about 1 million additional acres of land, lands that have been used for grazing, lands that have been in multiple use for decades, if not generations. And he did this, I mean, when you use the Antiquities Act, you change these landscapes with a single stroke of a pen. He doesn't need the approval of Congress. He doesn't need really even to consult with local communities. And unfortunately, the president didn't do any of that work, didn't have the support of local communities, didn't have the support of state government, but went ahead with these changes anyway. So what we're going to see, Tony, is yet another monument. Landscapes changed in name only, that the president gets to tout some sort of big conservation or preservation win. But the landscape, the community, the industry, certainly grazing community, will continue to suffer. Because using the Antiquities Act is unfortunately, it has become over time really just sort of a cheap political tool. So we're not super pleased, that the president, took this action in Arizona earlier this week. And it continues the need to have some common sense interjected into the Antiquities Act into the future.
She says part of the concern is the fact that the stakeholders need to have a say, and they didn't.
When you don't have community support and that involvement, a lot of these management considerations get missed. A monument designation is necessarily more restrictive than other designations, which is why it's a favorite tool of administrations. This president has already designated national monuments in excess of 5 million acres during his presidency, and that's a lot of land to lock up. With the designation of the monument, management doesn't necessarily change right away. You still have to go through a planning exercise. You still have to go through NEPA, environmental analysis. And so the administration can say, look, designating a monument doesn't do anything, but it only brings positive benefits. But we've seen with other monuments repeatedly. The most recent, of course, is the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument in Utah, that when you go through this monument planning exercise, the tendency, the expectation of these agencies is that they remove grading, they remove mining potential, they remove recreation potential, they remove all of the multiple use aspects from these landscapes that made these landscapes so special and so valuable in the first place in a lot of cases. So it is a really easy way for the president, any president, to say that they've done something, but the consequences for these communities are real, they're lasting, and they can be devastating. Sounds great on paper, not so great in implementation.
Caitlin Glover with the Public Lands Council. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
As we approach the 2023 Farm Bill, we should all work together to resolve flawed regulations, mounting uncertainty, and inflationary pressures.
Rob LaRue is president of the National Farmers Union.
Family farmers and ranchers are particularly vulnerable to the effects of inflation. Supply chain disruptions due to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, rapid shifts in demand and supply backlogs from the pandemic, and the lingering effects of trade dispute with China have all set the stage for rising costs for farmers and ranchers. These inflationary pressures are intensified by a lack of market competition in the food system. We have few buyers and sellers to choose from. As of 2019, the top four companies in the cattle trade controlled 85% of the market. For pork, that was 67%, and for broiler chickens, 53%. There's also heavy concentration in markets for corn and soybean seeds, herbicides, and pesticides. For tractors and other farm machinery, just three companies dominate the market. With such little competition, the opportunity for market manipulation and unfairness is greatly intensified, and this adds to inflationary pressure. For example, we've seen price fixing by meat packers and poultry integrators in recent years, with settlements totaling nearly $1 billion. Another lawsuit alleges the big four meat packers are manipulating the market. Major farm equipment manufacturers continue to refuse to provide us with access to the software tools to make repairs, and a mega merger between Kroger and Albertsons is expected to drive consolidation among processors, wholesalers, and distributors. We must create fairer and more competitive markets to drive innovation, increase choice, and decrease input costs and boost prices for crops and livestock. NFU believes family farmers and ranchers should be allowed to do what we do best, sustainably produce food, feed, fiber, and fuel. Regulations, when needed, should be science-based, size and risk appropriate, clear, and only implemented after thorough feedback. Unfortunately, this doesn't always happen. For example, confusing regulations and court decisions regarding the definitions of waters of the U.S. have made it difficult to comply with the Clean Water Act. Clean, safe water is an essential natural resource we work hard to protect, and regulators shouldn't make it so difficult for farmers to accomplish this. NFU is also concerned by a potential change in the longstanding policy on labeling of crop protection products. The change, based on a position taken by the U.S. Solicitor General in a brief to the Supreme Court, could open up the door to an impractical patchwork of labeling requirements that aren't science-based. One of the greatest sources of uncertainty farmers face is climate change. We're on the front lines of climate change with shifting weather patterns and increasingly severe weather events, making farming more unpredictable and difficult. Now more than ever, leadership on climate change is essential, which is why NFU is a proud founding member and co-chair of the Food and Agriculture Climate Alliance. Last week, FACA released Farm Bill recommendations aimed at helping us mitigate climate change and to make the entire farm and food system more resilient through a voluntary, science, and incentive-based approach. To address climate change, we should build on recent investments in Farm Bill conservation programs and renewable energy, the creation of USDA's partnerships for climate-smart commodities, and passage of the Growing Climate Solutions Act and the Sustains Act. By working together, we can overcome the challenges presented by faulty regulations, mounting uncertainty, and inflationary pressures.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
U.S. soybean production updates in August. The main story in both USDA's global production forecast and balance sheet.
The 2.6 million ton reduction in U.S. production is really what drives the changes in the global balance sheet this month.
World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Mark Jankowski says this led to a tightening of world soybean supplies and month-over-month adjustments down for most global supply and demand categories. Similar changes were made in most of the U.S. bean balance sheet for August as well.
Those tighter supplies are allocated between both reduction in our export forecast. We lowered by 25 million bushels, and the rest comes out of ending stocks, which we lowered 55 million bushels.
With tighter supplies contributing to a 30-cent increase in the season-ending average price, now at $12.70 a bushel. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.